Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Friday, November 14th, and everyone is talking about the economy in a variety of ways. Of course, the government has finally reopened as of yesterday. That doesn't mean that everything just immediately comes back online. There are still kind of some lagging issues. Of course, flights may still be disrupted over the next week or two, among a few other things. And then, of course, there's a lot going on with the economy. The Supreme Court has yet to weigh in on Trump's tariffs, which has really been his big push for how he wants to fix the economy. Then you have that clip from Secretary Scott Bessent saying that children born between 2025 and 2028 will get a $1,000 Trump account. And conservatives are kind of rejecting that premise and going, you know, do we really need that? And then also asking about the $2,000 stimulus checks, which apparently, according to the administration, if you make under $100,000, that is the only way that you would receive the $2,000 benefit. So that coupled with the SNAP benefits and how we've seen a lot of fraud and abuse of that, really, overall, I think a lot of people are questioning, is the Trump administration actually doing anything to bring down inflation, have affordable housing, not this ridiculous plan for a 50-year mortgage that basically says you'll just rent from the bank into perpetuity? But are there real solutions? Well, let's welcome in Tho Bishop, who is content director of the Mises Institute and one of our favorite economists that we like to have on the program. So, Tho, kind of big picture of the economy, where are we at kind of going into the end of Trump's first year and headed into what will be the year of the midterms?
I'm glad to be with you, Jenna, and just hearing you kind of hit some of those points, it kind of just seems like we have an economy being attempted to be put together with bubble gum and duct tape. And unfortunately, that's kind of where we're at. And, you know, when I joined you after Trump's election, one of the things I warned about is that the economy that he was inheriting going into 2025 was far, far worse than the economy that he got in 2017, the first time around. A big part of that is the massive, massive increase in government debt from COVID, the consequences that we're still dealing with, and everything that we're talking about right now, since there's we've now reopened the government with a hard-fought battle for spending levels at where Biden had them. Right. And so there's absolutely no serious debate going on. There's no political will to address the leading cancer in the economy, which is government spending, which leads to inflation, which leads to massive increases in affordability crises in a variety of different classes, housing being one of them. And so we're trying to financialize our way out of these very underlying problems that there's no political will to address. And so that's where the American economy is, you know, going to 2026.
Yeah, and I think you were very apt to warn the American people because, you know, there was a lot of enthusiasm at the beginning of Trump's term and, you know, hey, this is going to be changed and turned around kind of rapidly. And yet I think we're in a much different spot, especially after COVID and, you know, the decimation of what was the Trump economy coming out of the first term. We're in a very different situation. And then 4 years of Joe Biden. So contrast, you know, maybe for people who are still kind of in this first Trump era mentality, because we did have such a vibrant economy. What in your mind are the key differences between his first term and his second term in terms of just, you know, how he inherited the economy and then what his administration is doing to solve the economic issues by comparison and contrast the first and second term? Because I think there are a lot of differences.
There are. And, you know, a lot of them are things that he inherited. Some he has made worse. And like the tariff issue is one of them. Obviously, there were trade wars the first time around. China was the big fault line there. Tariffs were used more as a leverage tool to get new deals done. They were a lot more temporary in nature. And there's plenty of, you know, if you want to accept the administration's line, right, that ultimately at the end of the day comes to the notion of kind of reshoring, that we're going to use tariffs as a heavy tool to bring back investment. And let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say it works exactly like they suggest it will. The problem is that there is short-term pain in that process that can't be avoided in the realm of consumer price increases. And when you have that in 2024, rather than, like, say, 2026 or 2016, when inflation is up 50% from where it was last time around, that is a far harder hit for normal people to take. And so I think that's why affordability has become one of the number one issues, is because those kitchen table issues, the number one thing that Trump won in 2024, in 2016 he won on, you know, clearing out blue-collar jobs. 2024 he won because of inflation. And so the policies that are being prioritized now are not done with affordability in mind. They are done, if you get at the best benefit of the doubt, this broader restructuring. Maybe that pays off in 10 years. Maybe, right? You know, let's say, like, let's give them the benefit of the doubt there. In the short term, that's going to cause real, real pain. And then you add to that just the massive consequences of COVID-era inflation and housing, for example. All these things have gotten much, much worse. And the Fed has, you know, and that's why one of the biggest areas where Trump has attacked is the Fed. You're trying to get interest rates down, you know, and putting new people in the Fed. I'm all in favor of people criticizing the Fed. I don't think Powell's done a particularly good job. But the problem is that the answer is not lowering interest rates. Lowering interest rates was what got us in this situation that we're dealing with now. So like it's the desire to kick the can down the road on all these different fronts that is making the number one issue. That there is no more potent political issue. There's no more kitchen table issue than affordability, and that's the issue that, you know, I think that has not been prioritized properly, and we're dealing with the consequences of it today.
Yeah, and really affordability, I think you've hit on that key, because, you know, in the midst of the 50-year mortgage proposal, yeah, you know, Trump is talking about the price of turkeys. And as a guest, you know, earlier this week was saying, okay, well, people can't even afford houses to cook their turkey. So, you know, this isn't really as much in touch as perhaps the administration would like to think. This isn't just about saying, oh, well, if we lower the cost of gas prices, you know, that's all that people are worried about. I mean, this is overall affordability across the board, where the American way of life and the type of life that that young people especially have seen their parents and grandparents grow up with, they're thinking that that's out of reach. Like, there was, and I don't know if you saw this, Tho Bishop, my special guest this morning, the content director of the Mises Institute. There was a debate on X because Ben Shapiro was talking about how if you can't afford to live in the place that you grew up, well, you know, maybe move. And there was a lot of backlash against that. And I think they kind of parsed that clip a little bit out of context. But his point was, you know, if your parents are living in a very, you know, high income, very, you know, wealthy area, that doesn't mean that you as a new young adult basically are entitled to live in that same area just because you grew up in it. I mean, you do have to work and generate your own wealth and, you know, all of these kinds of things. But among the backlash, though, I think was at least a nugget of truth, where it seems like everyone who is under 40 is just constantly being told, no, 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 you have to wait, you have to wait, you can't afford homes, you can't afford to have, you know, these types of jobs that you want, you're going to have debt from credit cards and student loans into perpetuity. And I think that there is a real frustration there.
It is, because the economy has been rigged for everyone. The economy's gotten worse for every generation, ever since the boomers. And if you want, there's a website out there that's got a lot of interesting visuals and charts to document this, and has the unfortunate name, it's WTF happened in 1971.com. But it's got a lot of great visuals, because for one of the things that separates Austrian economics, the Mises Institute, kind of my particular flavor of free market, libertarian, call it what you will, from the rest, is this is why we focus on the Fed so much, because it's 1970s where everything changes. And it's going off the gold standard, which further empowers central bankers and this entire economy of financialization, which drained real resources from making stuff, from manufacturing, from all these issues that, you know, create the populist backlash that Trump won on in 2016, and put it into things that we became less about creating things and more about managing wealth. And it's a very parasitic economy. And so the people that have benefited, the only people that got richer during the Obama years were people that were invested highly in the stock market or other assets. If you were late, if you were working, if you were going paycheck to paycheck, your paycheck did not keep up. And you didn't get the benefit. And this is the way the economy has been structured, with escalation ever since the 1970s to this point. And so Reagan-era conservatism, all the traditional conservative talking points of tax cuts and deregulation, those things are good. But if you don't address the underlying issues of the Fed central bank policy and the rise of financialization, then all you're doing is making big business bigger, you're making investors richer, but you're not helping the working class. You can't have socialized money in a free market economy. And that's what America's had since the 1970s. So this is a fairly new phenomenon. And if you miss that part, then you're going to completely sell out what should be the celebration of free markets to solve these issues, because we're just pumping everything in the financial services industry. And we have all these bubbles, AI, big tech back in the day, housing, whatever. We have an economy built on bubbles off of speculation, rather than actually having your small town plumbing outfit or your small town factory, right? These are systemic issues that have eroded out those small towns to make it harder to stay where you grew up. And so that's an aspect I think everyone, both on the left and right, are missing. It's a very core component of it, of an economy that has been pervaded into financialization, not capitalism, and that goes right to the issue of money printing and the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Tho Bishop, who is the content director of the Mises Institute. And so, we've been talking this week as well about the frustration, particularly on the part of, young men who want to provide and have a family and, have, this wealth that they're building and have that sort of pride in ownership. And it does seem like a lot of this messaging is really out of touch. And especially when you look at the average age of a home buyer is, our people who have already been in the home ownership sphere for, a while. I mean, they're our parents and grandparents' age. It's not necessarily, new buyers. And so, do you think that the Trump administration actually has solutions for the next generation, or where should they be going, especially in this next year where we only have another year until the midterms? And, I frankly don't see Congress doing anything to help.
Well, no, unfortunately, this is why the 50-year mortgage, I think, is attractive, is because it's something that can be done with, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, it's an easy button to push. The problem is that ultimately there's two factors here. One is that the average underlying price of the home, not including mortgage rates, has bypassed average increases in income, almost 2-to-1. So houses have gotten 2 times more expensive than wage rates have increased over the last several decades, right? So that's what's causing the big generational issue. What is causing home prices to go up are a number of factors. One, we had a massive decrease in construction after 2008 for a variety of reasons there. Two, various regulations at the state and local level make it difficult to build. There's an aspect of it where we've had a million homes going to short-term Airbnb sort of rentals, taking that out of the housing stock, right? But all of this, there's also this very interesting pressure group in D.C. I used to work for the Financial Services Committee. One of the few gems of wisdom I got from Barney Frank, who was the leading Democrat, was that the most powerful interest group in D.C. is not big banks. It's realtors. Because there's so many realtors in every single congressional district in the world organized. A lot of my friends are realtors. I'm not trying to pick a swipe at them. But imagine if the underlying solution is for housing prices to go down, right? If we want more people to have internet access, we want more people to have comforts, right? cost of air conditioning goes down, cost of Wi-Fi goes down. You know, prices going down is usually a sign of how you solve these abundance issues, right? Well, imagine if housing prices actually went down. How many people's livelihoods depend upon their house going up? That's the underlying problem. There is a complete disconnect between individual self-interest of housing as an asset and the public policy side of it, which is making housing more affordable. And so you know, they're going to have to end up, you know, this is why I think the only political solution is going to be attaching Band-Aids to things, because there's such a labyrinth around the underlying supply side issue. Anything significant there immediately starts getting into really real conflicts of how average Americans view their house, again, not as simply a home, but as a financial investment. And so this is a very, very difficult issue. That's why, like, you know, I don't want to browbeat and demean anyone who, Bill Pulte or whatever, doing this sort of stuff. They're trying to fix something that is a very, very difficult problem. I think it's a problem that's been built up over decades, and we're now dealing with the reckoning of it.
Yeah, and you know, I really think that the Trump administration overall and the GOP, MAGA, however you want to categorize it, I really think they only have kind of this next year and maybe only the next half of the year until, you know, we really get into midterm election season to turn the economy around and show young people that we actually have some significant wins under our belt, and America's going in the right trajectory, because I think there is still, you know, that that frustration that, okay, it's now been almost a year that Trump has been in office. Where is the booming economy we promised? Where are the closed borders, the mass deportations? Where, you know, where is all of the wins on the Trump agenda that is what the American people voted by a wide margin, especially young people, for that Trump mandate. And so where do you see the Trump administration going over the next year? I mean, if they're a little out of touch, frankly, with some of these priorities, what would be your advice to the administration specifically on the economy, and especially if the Supreme Court in, you know, say February, March timeframe halts the tariffs and doesn't allow that to go forward? I mean, because that was Trump's really his big economic problem solving, solution there. And so if the Supreme Court does that, I think that that'll be kind of a blow to the Trump administration. So what would be your advice on how they should harness the next year to their advantage?
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing, because like if I was in the Trump administration, I'd kind of want to see the tariffs be taken down by Supreme Court order, and I'd complain about it, but then allow the decrease in prices that's going to come as a result of that in many areas, and then kind of take credit for that afterwards. Like, I mean, it's a dance, but that's what politics is. It's a dance, and maybe if you can have people recognizing an improving trend. In terms of kitchen table issues, again, that's not going to address the underlying issue with housing necessarily. That'd be one way to, I think, get a very easy sort of jolt there on the affordability issue. But the problem is that some of the best ways to handle some of this at a structural level were things that could have been done with the tax bill last time around. And some of those things, the no tax on tips thing, right, is something that is going to, I think, be a win when you're come April. Right, and you have a lot of the service industry class, particularly younger people, get a lot more money back during their tax season. Right, that's going to be something that they can see. Right, so what more can be done there? I mean, that's the problem, is you're doing a very short window, and Congress is not going to do anything meaningful. Congress is a useless institution at this point, and so I don't expect to get any major policy wins that can pass the Senate. And so it's going to be trying to massage. I think the biggest issue that's happening, increasingly clearing right now, is acknowledge the problem, and denying that we have an affordability crisis. I saw the president do this week. That's not benefiting him. Mm-hmm. And so you bring this back to look like, here is what we've inherited. Here's the problems that are going on. Here is what here are actual solutions to fix it. And the problem is that again, one of the major issues, right, with the whole government shutdown is Obamacare subsidies. This is an issue that everyone expected to happen, and yet there's no Republican solution to it. So until the Republican Party, until someone in Washington can outline, okay, well, here's an actual solution to this problem. We can't do it right now because X, Y, and Z, but here's what we can do. Here's something positive run on. Then I don't, you know, there's been so much good in the MAGA sphere in terms of policy agendas when it comes to higher education, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to all these areas, right? Economics has been kind of the area that has gotten some rhetoric without any sort of serious concrete policy proposals. That is exactly what we need right now, though, because, again, that's the issue. And I don't know who is the policy wonk right now that can seriously deal with this stuff. And so, like, that's, you know, what can be done in the short term outside of messaging. You know, I think that is the very dangerous place. The only good thing, the best silver lining, and this is a sad, this goes to the sad state of American politics as a whole, is that for all these issues, you know, there's only two parties. And the Democrats have no credibility on any sort of stuff, right? Everyone lived through the Biden years. Everyone knows that the Democrats voted in the Biden years. And so if people are concerned about affordability under Trump, are they so quickly going to say, oh, well, you know, let's go back to the other side because things are going great there? It worked to Trump's advantage in 2024 that people remembered the economy in 2019 before COVID was actually doing pretty well. Like, it was a lot better than the Obama economy. And so that nostalgic aspect of it, I think, was a huge, huge asset politically in the 2024 election. The Democrats don't have that. And so some would say it's not the greatest thing that our politics kind of race to the bottom there. But I do think that's an aspect of it, to just manage the fallout going to the midterms, but then regroup, but then get some ideas and maybe develop a political will to actually try to seriously cut spending rather than just normalize Biden-era budgets and the insanity of post-COVID government spending.
Yeah, political will. That's really what it comes down to. And the GOP is going to have to find itself and find the courage to actually want to govern is really the bottom line. And, you know, what I've been saying for months now. So, you know, well said, though. And before I let you go, I wanted your comment on, you know, a little bit more, you know, lighthearted story, but I think actually has an interesting impact. Fox News was reporting a coin loss. The United States ended the production of the penny on Wednesday. For more than 230 years, the penny has circulated through American piggy banks and cash registers, but rising production costs, each penny now costs nearly 4 cents to make, and shifts in consumer behavior have made it impractical to keep producing them. So fascinating. Do you think that this will actually have any effect on pricing, spending, or, you know, anything else?
I think any impacts there are going to be fairly marginal. I mean, it is going to slightly improve the bottom line of the mint because, you know, pennies did cost more than a cent to make, and that's not necessarily the best move there. I do know there's also kind of interesting movements around hoarding nickels because of the underlying mineral content of the metal content of the coins themselves. And so, like, I know some people that are stocking up on their nickels because, yeah, coming 10 years, this could be a good investment. I think there's other ways to place your money, but hey, that's your cup of tea, then more power to you. But again, this kind of, it goes down to the very troubling component of just, the devaluing state of our currency. And this is something that, has been going on for quite some time. And what's really good, that's the one thing I want to emphasize, and to not to go serious on a more lighthearted note, but, this entire inflationary economy that leads to the penny becoming devalued, becoming out of print, this is less than 100 years old. This is very, very modern in the grand scheme. This is not normal. And it's like, that's the real challenging thing, is that we're living very abnormal times when it comes to monetary policy, and the death of the penny is simply one of the symptoms of that.
Well, really fascinating stuff, Tho Bishop. Really appreciate your commentary today. We got to take a break here, but you can follow Tho Bishop at Tho, T-H-O, Bishop, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And there's been a lot of focus this week into the Trump administration launching 175 investigations into H-1B abuse. And so close to 200 investigations have been launched into that H-1B visa scheme for skilled workers. The enforcement initiative called Project Firewall began in September when President Trump announced the addition of a $100,000 fee for H-1B petitions. So there's a great article by Raw Egg Nationalist on InfoWars that you can go a little more into detail. But Raw Egg joins me now, and he's one of our favorites on this program just for a lot of in-depth analysis. We're going to get to, you know, a few other topics as well this morning. But Raw Egg, good morning. And, you know, I think that this is really fascinating in terms of the investigation into the abuse. Well, then Donald Trump went on with Laura Ingraham this week and was talking about how, you know, America doesn't have enough skilled workers, apparently, that we need H-1Bs. So while abuse is absolutely something that should be spotted, called out and all of that, I think where conservatives and the right are generally is that we don't necessarily want the H-1B program almost at all, not just to root out the abuse. So, you know, what's your perspective on all of this?
It's great to be back with you, Jenna. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's been some mixed messaging, really, from the Trump administration over the last couple of days. And certainly, if you've been on Twitter, if you've been on social media, then you'll know that people are getting quite upset about it. They're confused. They don't really know what's going on. Because, of course, you know, you must remember, before Trump actually returned to office in December, then there was a huge blow up about H-1Bs with Elon Musk wading in and then Vivek Ramaswamy. And of course, the outcome of that was that Ramaswamy was actually sort of deposed from DOGE and sent off, you know, to be to run for Ohio governor instead. And Elon Musk was kind of censured and backed off. But the H-1B thing is a big emotive issue because, you know, really it's the crux of America First, actually. You know, for a long time, this visa system has been abused by big companies to replace American workers with foreign workers who'll do the job for less. It's a money saving scam, is what it is. It saves money for these big companies. They import thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, mainly from India, because India is the largest beneficiary, and then China, and native workers, you know, who are more than qualified enough, lose out. So it's a real America First issue. And on the one hand, you know, over the weekend, we had this announcement that there's close to 200 investigations of companies abusing the H-1B system. But then you had President Trump speaking to Laura Ingraham, perhaps giving off maybe the wrong message, you know, when he said, well, you know, we don't necessarily have all the skilled people that we need. So we obviously we need this H-1B scheme. And then you had Kristi Noem, who also I think it was with Fox, she did an interview. And she said, oh, well, you know, it's great because we've got record numbers of naturalizations. And, you know, we're fixing the visa scheme so that more people can actually become naturalized Americans. Which isn't what people want, you know. That isn't the outcome that people wanted with immigration reform. What they actually wanted was fewer people to come in and more jobs for Americans. So it's been a bit of a confusing weekend, I must say. And this H-1B issue isn't going away. And I think it would be nice to have a crystal clear clarification, actually, from the Trump administration of exactly what the policy is.
Right. And where the policy should be, which, of course, necessitates that Congress act. And I have really lost any shred of faith that I've had in a Republican Congress to actually implement and legislate reforms that are advancing the America First agenda. But overall, if they miraculously decided to get it together, you know, we've seen that this is kind of a loophole to for companies to bring in these workers, pay them less, and basically hold this visa over them so that they can't switch jobs and they can't, you know, move around. I am all for, you know, personally saying we just need to halt immigration at all, even legally. For the vast majority, you know, not absolutely everything, but basically for 99% until we actually accomplish the mass deportations. But when we're talking specifically about H-1B, I mean, when we're talking about maybe reforms and solutions to this, do you think the U.S. should shift from employer-driven visas to maybe a merit-based immigration system like Canada or, you know, some of these other types of systems that we've seen? Because if they're not allowed to change employers freely, companies hold the visa over them as leverage.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously room for reform. I mean, the thing is, look, you have to look at what's happening in Canada, too. I mean, yes, they have a different system. They might have this merit based system. But I mean, Canada is being absolutely swamped with foreign workers as well. Mm-hmm. So we should be careful not to think that that system is without loopholes, that it can't be exploited, that it can't be used to do exactly the same thing that employers in the US are doing. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the, you know, good things that the Trump administration has done actually with the H-1Bs, although they backed off slightly, is imposing this fee that the employer has to pay, right? You know, so it looked like it was going to be $100,000 every single year of an H-1B visa that, you know, that an employer would have to put up in order to hire a skilled worker. Well, the Trump administration backed off and made it a $100,000 one-time fee. But even that is pretty steep, and that will be potentially be an incentive for companies, you know, to hire American labor rather than foreign. So, I mean, I think there are things that they can do within the confines of the H-1B system to ensure that actually, you know, okay, if there is some kind of situation where a company, Tesla, Microsoft, whoever, really does want to poach, you know, the cream of the crop, the top talent. And America, I think, should encourage that. I don't think there's anything wrong with America, you know, having as an immigration policy, we want the top talent in the world. But that isn't what the H-1B system is doing. The H-1B system is wholesale replacement, top to bottom, of companies with foreign workers. You know, it's basic level tech, it's entry level tech coders. It's not, you know, towering geniuses of the industrial world or the commercial world, whatever. So I think there's room within the system to reform further, to make it to increase the incentives for these companies actually to hire American, and then in special cases, yes, you know, you can make an application to poach someone from China or India or wherever, but you will have to pay a significant price in order to do that.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Raw Egg Nationalist. That is the moniker that he goes by on social media and in media. You can follow him on X. Also read a lot of the really good articles and the books that he's written as well. And we're talking about this whole overall H-1B visa issue. And Raw Egg, if Congress does nothing in the next 2 years, which about the next year before the midterms, and then they'll have to face kind of that reckoning. So even over just the next year, what do you believe the future of American labor looks like?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen some very positive developments. We've seen, you know, that actually there have been gains in the labor system for native born Americans for the first time in a long time. So it was announced, I think, that something like, you know, like a million, I think it was 1.2 million at least, foreign workers had left the labor force since Trump re-entered the White House. So there are definitely positive developments, and they're part of the kind of broader Trump immigration policy. You know, I mean, the ICE crackdown, the immigration crackdown, deportations, that's having an effect. That is making people self-deport. But I think unless the Trump administration really does get a handle on this H-1B issue soon, I think then, you know, there won't be any incentives for these big corporations not to game the system, not to continue bringing in tens, hundreds of thousands of principally Indian workers, but also Chinese. And, you know, that's going to hurt Trump's prospects. It's going to hurt America because you've got so many young people, so many heavily qualified Native Americans who are losing out on jobs. And it's creating, well, I mean, look, I mean, one of the principal effects, of course, has been of this dissatisfaction has been Zohran Mamdani in New York. I mean, if you don't, Tucker Carlson was talking about this, you know, and has talked about this over a long period of time. He did an interview with Ben Shapiro a few years ago where he said, look, if young people have no chance of buying a car, of owning a home, of settling down and having a family, then of course they're not going to have any attachment to capitalism. They're not going to have any attachment to the existing system. And so, yeah, they're going to say, oh, well, maybe socialism would be better. So I think now is a really very, very crucial time actually for action. You know, we've seen what's happened in New York. We've seen New York basically fall to an out and out communist, really, a man who talks about seizing the means of production. I mean, that's one potential future for America actually, if this issue isn't brought under control, if decisive action isn't taken.
Yeah, well said. And it'll be interesting to see how the Trump administration and also Congress decides to handle this over the next year. And the messaging, I think, is going to be key and definitely pivotal as we head into 2026. So, Raw Egg, I'm going to ask you to stay on the program because we have another topic to get to after the break. We'll have to take a break here, but we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And my guest, Raw Egg Nationalist, is still with us. And I want to talk about this other story that you also have in InfoWars. And the headline is Common Pesticides Linked to Falling Sperm Counts. Commonly used pesticides that could interfere with male hormones, damage testicular tissue, and reduce sperm counts, according to a new meta study. In recent years, there has been growing alarm about precipitous declines in sperm counts. One world expert, Professor Shauna Swan, has predicted that on the basis of current trends, natural reproduction could be impossible by the middle of the century. This is really shocking, and yet, you know, I think just goes to the overall concern that a lot of conservatives on the right, and of course we've been called conspiracy theories for this, have long suspected with places like the World Economic Forum, you know, Bill Gates and others, with literally trying to sterilize the world in order to decrease the population or at least have population control. So what's actually going on here?
Yeah, so sperm counts have been declining precipitously for decades. Now, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2021, there was a book published by Professor Shauna Swan, who I mentioned in the article, called Countdown. And she did the rounds. She did Joe Rogan. There was a big media tour. She predicted in the book, and in fact, she had predicted before the book, I think in academic articles, she's a world expert at Mount Sinai University in New York. She's not a crank. She's a world expert. She predicted on the basis simply of the trends in sperm counts that by the middle of the century, 2045, I think it was, the median man would have a sperm count of zero. And so what that means is that one half of all men will have no sperm and the other half will produce so few that it doesn't really matter because they'd never get a woman pregnant. You know, you have to have a certain amount of sperm, certain concentration of sperm in order to have a chance to fertilize an egg. So these are worrying statistics and we've known about them for a while, but there's been growing alarm about them and growing awareness actually in recent years. And Professor Shauna Swan has pointed in her kind of explanation of these trends to our exposure to harmful chemicals, to plastic chemicals. You know, we live in a plastic world. We're surrounded by, we're bathed in plastic chemicals, but also things like herbicides and pesticides. And so this new study is a study of a class of fairly new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. And they've really only started to be used in large quantity in the last sort of 15, 20 years. They're designed to attack the nervous system of insects. And it turns out, surprise, surprise, that they also have nasty effects in humans as well. But they're used in enormous quantities now, really huge quantities. So I think I say in the article, you know, 90% of soy in the US is treated with neonicotinoids, 50% of corn, or possibly actually the other way around. No, it's 90% of corn and 50% of soy. So they're used everywhere, and they're used on vegetables and fruits. And what's particularly worrying about them actually is that not only do they have these very unpleasant effects, as this meta study shows. A meta study is a study of studies. So it's they were looking at something like, I think, 30 different studies of the effects of neonicotinoids. But it's actually very difficult to get these chemicals out of produce once they're in them. So, you know, you're often told, oh, well, you know, you should wash your fruit and vegetables to get rid of any chemical residues. Well, the unfortunate thing is that neonicotinoids end up in the flesh of the fruit and vegetables as well. So you can't wash that out. You can wash the stuff that's off the surface, but you can't, you know, wash out the chemicals that are inside the flesh of an apple. You would destroy the apple. So, you know, most Americans are now being exposed to these harmful chemicals on a daily basis. And we have, you know, good reason to believe that actually it could be having very, very serious effects on their health, and probably not just fertility too. It will be having other effects as well. So we know that, you know, other pesticides not only have effects on fertility, but also have effects on metabolism. They drive obesity, they drive diabetes, some drive cancer. So it's worrying. But at least we now have some kind of, you know, organized governmental campaign. We have Make America Healthy Again to try and address Americans' exposure to these harmful chemicals, because, like I say, by the middle of the century, you know, it could be too late actually for us to reproduce as a species,
which is just, you know, utterly idiotic, frankly. I mean, the humanity literally depends on reproducing, and that is God's design, of course, for the family, and why conservatives have always said that the family and marriage cannot be redefined. There have been issues with, you know, utilizing IVF in an ethical framework that is much more narrow than what, you know, a lot of advocates would suggest. And so, you know, we're kind of seeing this overall attack on fruitfulness and family formation. So do you see a moral dimension here that society is perhaps intentionally even creating an environment hostile to the nuclear family and the overall feminization of men and cultural weakening? Because, you know, many conservatives are arguing that the cultural messaging, educational norms together, and now these environmental chemicals that are forcing kind of a feminization literally of males are together contributing to this wider erosion of masculine identity.
Yes, yeah, it's a complicated situation. I mean, really what we're dealing with is kind of a witch's brew of these negative factors that are all making it harder and harder for people to reproduce, to have children. So, yes, I mean, we have this biological, this chemical assault on our bodies. We've created a world, a society in which we are bathed in harmful chemicals, in which, you know, the very existence of this society depends on industrial processes that pollute the world tremendously and, you know, make it impossible for us to avoid being exposed to chemicals that seriously damage our health and fertility. But then, yes, you've got this cultural and social assault too that's taking place as well. You know, I mean, it's just not only is marriage and family disparaged within the general culture, largely thanks to the kind of pervasive influence, the domination of the left. The left, you know, dominates the culture. It dominates the institutions, the universities, the schools, you know, the media, cinema, music, whatever. So we've, you know, there's this consistent messaging, this consistent denigration of the family, of you know, getting married, having children, monogamy, all this kind of stuff. And then you also have economic conditions as well. You know, it's just like I was saying earlier, you know, it's just harder and harder for young people to do the kind of things that are necessary to create the kind of stability, the kind of economic stability that's necessary actually to settle down and have children. So, you know, you've got a lot of young people who don't end up having enough money to buy a house, having enough money to have the space and the security to actually settle down and have a family. So it's an assault from all sorts of from multiple angles at once, and it's having a tremendous effect. And you know, we were talking about immigration in the previous segment. You know, it's driven down fertility and birth rates, native birth rates, you know, to such an extent that actually mass immigration is one response to that. You know, mass immigration provides the birth rates. You look at a country like Germany, it's mass immigration that maintains a positive birth rate there. It's all connected. All of these policies, all of these decisions that have been made are all connected, and all of the negative effects are interconnected as well. So it's very, very complicated. It's a nasty tangle to unpick.
Yeah, and it's one of those things too that I think we would be wise as conservatives to look at this very seriously and not allow this conversation to be relegated to the sort of conspiracy theorist lens that the left, of course, would like to project and say, well, you know, you just have this view that everyone is out to get men and all that. Well, I think that's true, that they actually are, and from a lot of different angles. And so with something like these chemical pesticides and how, you know, food overall isn't healthy, we've talked about that at length with you, Raw Egg Nationalists. We've talked about the overall MAHA movement. So many of these things, whether it's with the food supply or chemicals, these are things that we probably as just ordinary citizens can't necessarily avoid, at least entirely. And so especially for young men who don't want to have this ultimate outcome of infertility, what are their best options?
Yes, I mean, like you say, it's a difficult situation. You can't escape these chemicals, and the best example of this is microplastics. You know, with this microplastics, which are tiny little pieces of plastic, mostly invisible to the eye, are everywhere, and they're in the news a lot, but scientific research is showing, you know, that they are everywhere. They're in alpine snow, they're in the rain, they float around in the air, they're in dust in your house. You know, they're everywhere. You can't escape them. So what we have to do fundamentally is, at least on an individual level, is focus on mitigation strategies. How can I reduce my exposure as much as possible? And so with these neonicotinoids, for example, that I talk about in this piece for InfoWars, the best thing you can do is to eat organic. That would be the best thing. Like I say, you can't get neonicotinoids out of the flesh of an apple or a strawberry or whatever. So the best thing you can do is to buy organic from a trusted source. I mean, unfortunately, that means that you're going to have to spend a bit more money. But I say to people, look, you have to think of your health as an investment. Every extra cent or dollar that you spend on food, on good food, better quality food, is an investment in your health that you might not then have to pay in healthcare bills. You know, when you don't develop diabetes, when you don't get massively overweight, when you don't develop thyroid cancer or something. You know, so you have to think of it, I think, as an investment. But yes, I mean, it's mitigation strategies. It's eating organic. It's avoiding using plastic as much as possible, avoiding processed food, preparing your own food at home rather than buying fast food or food from the store. It's simple stuff like that. But we also obviously need to rely on the regulators. We need to rely on people like RFK Jr. To reform the system, you know, so that these harmful chemicals actually aren't out there in the environment in the first place.
Well said. And this is why the MAHA movement, I think, is central to the America First agenda overall. And this is something that, regardless of what else Congress does or doesn't do, or you know, the economic issues or other things that are incredibly important. This does need to be a priority, and I so appreciate you, Raw Egg Nationalist, for always bringing this to the attention of the American people. Again, you can find those articles at InfoWars and elsewhere. And have a great weekend. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.